Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What separates the world's most influential thinkers from those who are merely very intelligent? Having spoken one-on-one with many of the seminal intellects of the contemporary world and closely studied several who came before, my guest today has found an extraordinary pattern in people from Benjamin Franklin to Albert Einstein to Louis Armstrong, Bill Gates, and Madeleine Albright. Beyond just brilliant minds, they have curious and imaginative ones. Walter Isaacson is CEO of the Aspen Institute. He is also former chair and CEO of CNN and managing editor of Time magazine. His newest book is called American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and Heroes of a Hurricane. Walter, welcome back to Think.
Hey, it's great to be back with you, Chris.
You know, reading this book over the weekend, it really struck me how much we tend to miss when we marginalize our understanding of creativity as something that is the realm of artists and novelists.
Yes, you know, I think creativity is something to be celebrated in all realms. And when I was writing about Benjamin Franklin a few years ago, I did a biography of him, I realized how much he loved science, how he would chase whirlwinds when he was out riding his horse, how he would look at the Gulf Stream and measure it every time he crossed the Atlantic, how he would understand northeastern storms and botany and leaves and electricity. And so it made me want to do a great scientist. I did Einstein and even math. For him, it was like an equation was a good Lord's brushstroke for painting something in physical reality. So I wanted in my work to convey the excitement of creativity, not rote learning, because sometimes those of us who aren't scientists or mathematicians kind of think that literature and music is creative, but science and math are rote learning.
Yeah, and in fact, Einstein comes across here as a guy who really just took the time to notice things and wonder about things that the rest of us just completely take for granted.
It's wonderful to have that passion for curiosity. When he was 5 or 6 years old, his dad gave him a compass, and he went out into the back, you know, of his house, and he said that for hours and then days on end, he would tremble with excitement at the needle twitching point north, and he would stay up at night watching. He said nothing touched it. There was nothing touching the needle, but you moved it, and it would twitch, and it would point, you know, and move. And you and I remember getting a compass when we were age 6, and we'd go and say, oh, wow, look, it points north. And a minute later, you know, we'd be on to something else. We'd say, oh, look, a dead squirrel, and we'd forget all about the compass. That passion to figure out, what is a force field? How does a force field, a magnetic field, work? How does it make things move? You know, until his deathbed, on his deathbed, he was still writing field equations, trying to figure out why a force field affects a solid object.
And felt very strongly that nobody, scientist or non-scientist alike, could afford to disengage from science.
Right. You know, one of the problems, and he's partly responsible for it, old dear old Dr. Einstein, is if you were in Benjamin Franklin's generation with Thomas Jefferson and people like that, you would never disengage from science. You know, you would be considered a Philistine if you didn't keep up with the latest advances in science and technology. But in the 20th century, Einstein and the other great scientists came up with all these very complicated or seemingly intimidating theories. And if you weren't a scientist, you got kind of intimidated by science. And you and I have friends who would never admit that they don't know the difference between Hamlet and Macbeth, or between a Picasso and a Rembrandt. And yet they would happily admit they don't know the difference between a gene and a chromosome, or between relativity theory and uncertainty principle. And we've let it be accepted that if you're not a scientist, you can say, gee, it's too intimidating. I don't understand science. Whereas in previous generations, as I said, you'd be considered a Philistine if you didn't understand science. So I wanted to, we can't sort of say, oh, we want our kids to learn science and math, and we'll try to get teachers to cram it into their heads. If we're taking them to ball games, and we're taking them to concerts, and we're taking them to art museums, but we say, oh, we don't do science and math, we're too afraid of it, then our kids will be slightly intimidated by science and math. We should throw ourselves into science and math.
So in addition to sort of hoping to re-spark our passion for curiosity and for questions, this is also an homage to great storytelling and what it can do for us. Can you talk about that a little bit?
You know, I once had this mentor, Walker Percy, mm-hmm. the great, great Southern novelist. I'm sure your listeners know him. He wasn't that famous. And when I read his novels, I was about 15 years old, I finally realized that there was great messages in them. Like he called them the messages in the bottle. And there was even theological or religious themes. And I would grill him about it, and he'd just kind of shrug and smile. And he finally said, you know, there are two types of people come out of Louisiana, preachers and storytellers. He said, for goodness sake, be a storyteller. We got far too many preachers in this world. And so I've always believed in the power of narrative storytelling to convey lessons. You know, it's like the Bible does it. You know, it starts with the greatest lead sentence ever. You know, in the beginning, you know you're going to get a narrative tale. And we've lost that in journalism today to some extent because everybody wants to go on cable shows and talk radio and do shout their opinions at somebody else, as opposed to saying, let me just report something and tell you the story.
Yeah, you write here about the guiding premise of Time magazine, where you worked for years, which was that you contribute to contemporary history essentially by telling the stories of the people who are making that history. What is it that individual actors and the study of them really contributes to our sort of getting it and having it feel human and relevant?
Well, Henry Luce, when he invented time, kind of said, let's tell the history of our time to the people who make it. Time used to always put a person on the cover, almost always. And when I was editor of Time, I always liked to put people on the cover, including obscure people like Mark Andreessen, you know, some barefooted student who had invented what became the first real web browser, Netscape web browser, or, you know, great scientists and thinkers, but also interesting artists and musicians, and say, hey, you should know about this person and learn the values of our time through the people who make it. And once again, that's sort of a biblical thing because, you know, you tell moral tales through the tales of Adam and Eve and Moses and people and Jesus, and that's the best way to convey moral thinking. So when I wrestle with a Benjamin Franklin, I say to myself, what were his values? How did he believe in certain values-based leadership? How was that reflected in his life? And by telling about his life, I can talk about the notion that in a very contentious period where all sorts of passionate people like Sam Adams and John Adams and Jefferson and Madison all were fighting over various things, he was somebody who said, let's figure out how we find the common ground. And he would say, compromisers may not make great heroes, but they do make great democracies. That's something we're missing in our world today, in our politics in America today, is this notion of how do we unify rather than become more partisan. But the way to tell that moral lesson was through the life of Benjamin Franklin. Likewise, Einstein tells a lesson about the beauty of science. And even a Henry Kissinger tells a lesson, you know, another book I wrote and some essays I do in this book, about brilliance, true brilliance in foreign policy, but it being divorced from the idealism and the values of our country and how that can cause problems.
Yeah, it is interesting when we think about the value of compromise in that in the modern world, it's viewed as weakness. It's never seen as it was in the days of Benjamin Franklin as a sort of strength.
Yeah, I think that's a real problem we have today. I mean, Benjamin Franklin made his list of virtues, and he used to practice them all. And finally, a friend said to him, you know, you're kind of forgetting one you should practice. And Franklin said, what's that? And the friend said, humility. You might want to try that one for a change. And Franklin said, I was never very good at the virtue of humility, but I was good at the pretense of it. I could fake it very well. And it taught me to compromise. It taught me to believe or show that I thought that there was some merit in another person's opinion, not just my opinion, and so we would try to find common ground. And that was the essence, he said, of the democracy we were trying to create. Now, there's 100 reasons in this day and age, from the partisanship in the media to the way we gerrymander congressional districts, that we've become so bitter and partisan that on an issue like health care, where you could find 75-80% of this country would have 80% of the things they agree on. We could all agree on everything from pre-existing conditions to you know, not being dropped from your insurance to the notion that we want to get as many possible people covered by insurance. We could all agree on these principles, but instead you have an exact party line vote where it's all totally partisan. And you see that over and over again. And to me, we got to get away from that notion that compromise is some sign of weakness rather than some sign of the decency and humility that make a democracy.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number to become a member of KERA. We'll resume our conversation with Walter Isaacson in just a moment about his new book, American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and Heroes of a Hurricane. If you would like to join this conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org. We are in our winter membership campaign right now. We are asking everyone who listens to KERA, who loves to be able to turn on the radio and find a great conversation like this one with Walter Isaacson. So much wisdom in this book, so many interesting stories about his own career and about the people he has covered. We would love to be able to send you a copy of the book when you join the station today with a $120 contribution. Of course, you can go out and buy the book and make the amended contribution to KERA. The list price is something like $26. We invite you to do that. We're not tricking you into thinking that the book costs $120. We buy it for $26 and then we sort of take that money out and then use the rest of your contribution to support the work that you really love here.
Yeah, and just to be completely straight about it, you know, sometimes, Chris, the publisher even sends us some copies so we can save a little bit of money that way too. But we just provide this book to you when you join the station so that, you know, you can have a token of our appreciation for your contribution.
This is really, it's a wonderful book, and it's very much, if you're a Think listener, this is the sort of book that I know you'll want to pick up, because there's so many different ideas in here about just taking the time to look at things from a different perspective than you have already. And there are politicians in here of all political stripes. You know, Walter mentioned Henry Kissinger, the Clintons are in here, and Madeleine Albright. There are Ronald Reagan, Mikhail Gorbachev. There are a variety of figures, and it just sort of invites you to sit back and look at their lives and their achievements and what made them such influential people in the world. We think those are wonderful values, and we love to be able to bring them to you on the show. Your support makes it possible at 1-888-694-6931.
The number is 888-694-6931. You can also join online at kera.org. This is your public radio station, and we're asking you to do your part to support it because you listen. You've already chosen to spend what I think of it as one of your most valuable resources, your time, listening to the station, using it as the soundtrack of your day-to-day. Maybe think as your companion during lunch or at the office. Maybe you have a different working schedule and you get up in the morning and you listen to this show as your first sort of getting hold of the day. Well, if that's worth something to you, then I would ask you to put a dollar value on it and call right now. It's 888-694-6931, or contribute online at kera.org. Only with your support can the station remain strong and continue to bring you programs and interviews like this one with Walter Isaacson and the day-to-day programming that you hear right here on KERA.
Thanks so much to Steve Stump in Dallas, Kara Ranta in Sunnyvale, and all of you who are calling, including Lavette Ulichny in Flower Mound and Lauren Barnacle in Dallas. Thanks to all of you who have been making the call. Apologies to all of you whose names I have just butchered. It is unintentional, and we read them quickly and without pronouncers, but the thanks is genuine, even if the pronunciation is poor.
Yeah, absolutely. We'd love to thank you. We'd love to hear the phone ring. We'd love to hear your contribution come in at 888-694-6931. You can also contribute online, don't forget, at kera.org. It takes about 90 seconds to fill out the member form. You fill it out for yourself, and you can choose a thank you gift as well there if you want to. So please do your part right now, 888-694-6931, or online at kera.org.
And podcast listeners, even if you listen in time delay, certainly the phone number still works, and the website is always available.
Oh, yeah.
So we don't want to let you off the hook here. If you listen and enjoy the podcast, we also really would appreciate your support of the station. 1-888-694-6931, or online at kera.org. Back in just a minute with Walter Isaacson.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Walter Isaacson. He is CEO of the Aspen Institute, former CEO of CNN, and managing editor of Time Magazine. His newest book is called American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and Heroes of a Hurricane. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. I want to go back for just a minute, Walter, to this issue of compromise. We talk a lot about finding common ground. I wonder if you think that it is a matter of simply finding where we can all agree, or is this something that has to be actively built with the efforts of people on all sides of a question?
Oh, I think it has to be actively built, but it has to be actively built upon our values. I mean, we all know, go back to healthcare if you want. We all know that none of us have as part of our value system that people should be on, that there should be a lot of people uninsured and who can't afford to get health care. And we all know in our values that we have to have a society that contains costs so that we're not just throwing, you know, money that we don't have at every single problem. And so you could say, well, let's have a grand compromise, because I think Democrats have pushed very hard on getting everybody, as many people, covered, and Republicans have often pressed hard on containing costs, and say, well, let's try to figure out, based on this common ground, how we can have a grand compromise here. Well, we do a bill that contains some of the costs seriously, and we also do a bill that provides basic level health care to as many possible people in our society. So that's how you say, look, here are the values we share. Where can we go? How do we get from here to there to putting those into practice?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Patrick in Richardson. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. Great show again. Mr. Isaacson, I used to live in Aspen, and I want to tell you that I've seen some just amazing lectures up at the Aspen Institute on such
a great. Come back.
I will. My comment is that, you know, speaking about Ben Franklin, you know, I don't know the whole list of the other guys that you have in your book, but there is this adage, or not this adage, but this air of overall benevolence and the ability to stand on your own, but then also apply reason. But this overall sense of benevolence that all these men, with their compassion, they all had something in common in the way that they had an inner moral code that you don't see repeated off very much in the human population, but yet you see common denominators in all these men, and necessarily how they were almost servants of reality. And I know that sounds mystical and weird, but I can't wait to read your book. And Chris, just great show, and thank you.
Thanks for your
call. Hey, I really appreciate that comment. And indeed, you know, being benevolent is a basic human instinct. We see it coming out in this crisis in Haiti, where people do care about helping others. And that's part of the values that we all balance, is a sense of benevolence. When I grew up in New Orleans, write a lot about New Orleans in that book, and I talk about all the benevolent people who came to our aid after the storm. As a nation, we began with barn buildings. You know, people would, the pioneers would come, and they'd go to a town, and people would help their neighbors raise the barn. And so I think benevolence is still ingrained into our character.
New Orleans is, for many people who've been there and really love the city, this sort of magical place. And as you describe it, there's an interesting combination of things. It's a place where high culture and low culture and prosperity and poverty all not only coexist, but in some ways feed off one another, for better and for worse. Will you talk about that?
I think it's part of the mix of creativity, is when you have different types of people, different ethnic groups, different people with different backgrounds, all jangling with each other. And of course, it causes some frictions, but it also causes some sparks, and the sparks are good and sometimes bad. And, you know, in Texas, it's one of the most creative states we have. Why? Because there's such a different and diverse mix of people. So the good thing about New Orleans, to me, was growing up in a mixed neighborhood with all, you know, various races and classes of people. And you shared things from jazz to the New Orleans Saints to a love of spices in your food. But you also occasionally had the frictions that come. And you look at the problems that we have in the world today, it all comes from, not all, but a lot of it comes from tribalism. Whether it's the Sunnis and the Shias, you know, it's tribal, or whether it's, you know, the Islamic fundamentalists versus others. And the magic of America, especially the Ben Franklin vision of America, was you could have a town, and when he ran away to Philadelphia, it had Jews and Anglicans and Quakers and Moravians and blacks and slaves and freed slaves and all sorts of people, and they all tolerated and eventually learned to respect each other. To me, that is the beauty of what America's system is about, and it's also the source of our creativity. And I must say, I worry when we become too closed down as a society, when we start hating immigration too much, when we start hating other types of people, that we're going to lose the beauty of what makes our country so creative.
Louis Armstrong grew up in the same neighborhood you did in New Orleans.
And I used to play jazz, and I played clarinet, not cornet and trumpet the way he did, and played with people who had once played with Louis Armstrong. And, you know, to me, jazz and Louis Armstrong is an example of transcending tribalism, if I can use a fancy phrase there. Meaning, you know, there he was, a poor waif, you know, a virtually abandoned child at age 7 or 8, 9, ends up being raised for a few years in what was called the Colored Waif's Home, an orphanage. He's in a neighborhood where a Jewish family, the Karnofskys, give him his first job sort of playing a tin horn on the back of their peddler's truck. It's a neighborhood that has blacks and whites, same neighborhood now. It's that, you know, Central City, Broadmoor area of New Orleans, where different groups all came together from, you know, Italians to people who had fought in the Spanish and American War and were in the bands and brought their trumpets back. And you had ragtime music and you had the old gospel hymns and you had plantation blues and you had the Creole orchestras, and all that flows together to form jazz. So it's a narrative way for me to say different strands of different types of creativity from different types of people flow together to create something as beautiful as jazz. Louis Armstrong's life is a symbol of that, and it's a way of talking about how diversity and creativity can reinforce each other.
Armstrong is also fascinating in that he was, by every account, a very serious artist, and yet entirely comfortable with the notion that he was also there to make people happy.
That's always this great divide of, you know, are you selling out? Are you an artist or are you an entertainer? Especially the bebop jazz musicians, Miles Davis, whatever. For a while, they considered Louis Armstrong a sellout. There he is, you know, singing Hello, Dolly or something. And they say, you know, he used to be a great artist when he did West End Blues or when he did Muscat Ramble, but now he's selling out and doing Hollywood-like things. I think Louis Armstrong would not, and I'm sure since he said it often, that Louis Armstrong would not have made that distinction. He started off at age, you know, 4 doing tap dances on the sidewalk and playing his little trinket toy trumpet in order to make a little money so that he and his sister and others could eat. And entertaining people and making a little bit of money at it was not considered something shameful by him. He was quite proud that he could do it.
Walter Isaacson is here. The new book is called American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and Heroes of a Hurricane. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. And next we go to Pablo in Dallas. Hello, Pablo.
Hi, Chris. It's Pablo from the Texas Lyceum.
Hello.
Love your show.
And you.
Mr. Isaacson, thank you very much. The Aspen Institute is key in promoting leadership and this kind of thought in the U.S.
And congratulations on the Texas Lyceum, which is also a great institution.
Well, Clark Irvin's an alum, and there's a lot of good affinity there. So,
Clark's up here down the hall from me right now.
There you go. My question is, how can you promote the kind of thinking that you describe in the book by people like Einstein and Franklin, but also modern figures like Baker and Kissinger and Albright and Powell and others? How can we teach that to the next generation, and how can we promote that to the current generation? And one example is, you know, we've been homeschooling 16 years. My 8-year-old daughter asked me, without any prompting, without any teaching at all, she said, "Daddy, if I were traveling faster than the speed of light, would everything else be frozen?" How can I teach her how to think like Ben Franklin and Einstein, and how can we promote that among the current generation?
Well, first of all, when a child asks you something like that, there's two possible responses. One is, gee, I don't know, you know, and I never was good at science. And the other is, let's explore, let's find out. And with the internet and with, you know, libraries, it's easy to explore and find out. And no, you can't travel faster than the speed of light. But if you get right up to the speed of light, yeah, things are frozen. Time slows down until it stops, which is why, by the way, you can't go faster than the speed of light. So those are the type of things that can absolutely entrance a child. But I don't think we can say, let's outsource that to, you know, the teachers in our fifth grade. We have to convey that excitement that we do for certain aspects of our life to all aspects of learning. Secondly, in our schools, you know, we shouldn't. We used to have the best school system in the world. We used to have more highest rate of high school graduation, highest in science and math. Now we may be 17th in the world. We shouldn't have a nation in which our math, science, and reading scores are about 17th to 20th in the world, and that our high school graduation rates are comparably low. We also shouldn't have an education system that is two-tiered, or three-tiered in the case of homeschooling, but where your child and my child, you know, get a pretty good education, but some people are consigned to, you know, school districts where some people don't get, you know, good shot at life. So I think we have to dedicate ourselves to education, and sometimes people say, well, is memorizing and rote, isn't that bad? And I say, well, Einstein thought out of the box, but before he thought out of the box, he knew what was in the box. So he understood, you know, the multiplication tables and everything else before he started doing the type of calculus that got him to relativity theory. So I think that we should promote creativity in our schools, music and arts education, but also promote science and math education as something wow and fun.
Walter Isaacson is with us. He's CEO of the Aspen Institute, and his latest book is called American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and Heroes of a Hurricane. We'll resume the conversation in just a couple of minutes. You can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We are pleased to have on hand some copies of Walter's new book, American Sketches. That's available when you make a contribution of $120 or more to KERA. You can either do it online at KERA.org or by calling our toll-free number, new number, same deal, 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is back. He is senior producer of Think and, of course, the host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know on Fridays. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And just want to thank everybody who's called in so far during the show today. We're still waiting to hear from you at 1-888-694-6931 or online at KERA.org. I want to say thanks specifically to Marty Cagle in Fort Worth, Elena Bohm, Bore in Flower Mound. Sorry about that, Elena. And Hari Kodakala in Irving. Thank you so much for your contributions at KERA.org or by calling 1-888-694-6931. We'd love to thank you. You know when you make that call, you are contributing over half the revenue necessary. Not you personally, but you along with everyone else. Your contributions make up half the money that it takes to keep this station strong, to keep it healthy, to keep it on the air. And that's why we say, and it's the truth, that you are the focus of the programming here. It's not about whoever's on the air. It's about you. We bring you conversations, and we invite you to participate in them because that's what this is all about. But three times a year, and this is one of them, we come to you and say, hey, we need your help. We need you to make your contribution so that we can keep doing everything on behalf of you.
The one place, you know, even when we have to tighten our belts based on the economy, the one place we don't cut corners is programming. We won't do it. We're proud of that. It's one of the values that we embrace here. We want to make sure that everything sounds on the air perfect to you and that, you know, you may not agree with everything that, is ever presented on the station, but we know that if you listen sort of in the gestalt, you will get a variety of different ideas and you will understand your world, not from one perspective, not from one political point of view, but from a broad-based perspective. We are really proud of that. But it's only possible because we have the support of the people who listen, people who call 1-888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. It just takes a couple of minutes to make this contribution. And let me ask you this. If you've done it, if you're a current member, maybe you joined last drive or maybe you've just rejoined, would you, if you're on a social media site of any kind, just let your friends know that you have just renewed your membership to KERA or remind them to flip on the radio and make their contribution right now?
Yeah, we want you to be proud of your public radio station as well. We want you to be proud enough to support it financially with a contribution at a level that's right for you, and you know what that level is. You know what works in your budget. And the door is open right now. The phones are standing by. There are people there to talk to you at 888-694-6931. You can also go online to kera.org. And as Chris said, if you have made your contribution, we'd love for you to tell your friends and contacts that you know, you did your part and you're proud of your public radio station, and that they should be as well, and that they should support it just like you did.
Every once in a while, we'll hear somebody sort of grumble about, you know, the fundraising campaigns, and we too love to be, you know, doing content for the entire hour and not pausing. But if you'll stop for just a minute to compare the amount of time, even in a fundraising campaign, that we spend raising money with a typical hour every day of every week of every year on a commercial radio station, you can see how much farther we go to bring you conversation the entire time.
Yeah, even during a fundraising campaign, we still spend nearly 40 minutes talking with a guest on this show. And, you know, we have a couple of station breaks. There's a newscast, which is 5 minutes long at the top of the hour. So you're still getting quite a bit of content, even though we're asking you to support the station. And we only do this a couple of times a year. We open the, you know, we open up the mics, we come on the air, we say, look, we need you to do your part so that we can get back to the regular schedule as quickly as possible. And you can help us wrap this drive up. You can help us get it over with. Because remember, the drive ends for you when you call 888-694-6931 or contribute online at kera.org.
You can choose a thank you gift if you are interested. We have copies of American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and Heroes of a Hurricane available at the $120 contribution level. Of course, you can make a contribution at whatever level. Go out and buy the book. It's really a great read and the sort of thing I think that you'll want to pass on to friends and other people that you want to discuss it with. We would love to hear from you right now. 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. So far during Think, we've raised about $5,000. That's terrific, but we would love to raise more and finish with fundraising as soon as possible and bring you the programming that you love. Your support is critical to this. 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. Back in a minute with Walter Isaacson.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Walter Isaacson. He is CEO of the Aspen Institute, former CEO of CNN, and managing editor of Time Magazine. His new book is called American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and Heroes of a Hurricane. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Walter, as you well know, a lot of media organizations are having a tough time surviving these days. Newspapers are folding and really condensing the amount of content they provide. You've got what you call a bold, old idea for saving journalism. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was a Time Magazine cover story I wrote exactly a year ago, and everybody said it was totally crazy. There would be no possible way that people would ever pay for online journalism or content. Now, after a year, it's suddenly becoming much more thinkable. I think the New York Times and other newspapers are, in the next month or two, going to experiment with paid models for online content. Whether it's Journalism Online, an organization run by Gordon Krovitz and Steve Brill, or I'm going out this coming week to California for the announcement of what I hope will be Apple Computer's new tablet or Slate that will allow us to read and do content. The Kindle Reader from Amazon is another great example. People are starting to pay a little bit for content. Now, I still think most of the stuff we get on the web will be free, But I don't think you're ever going to have good journalism if we have to give it away for free all the time, because you don't want to be totally advertising supported. You know, your NPR station is so good because it's supported by your listeners, not really by advertisers. I think that a good journalistic organization should have a mix where you might have some advertising revenue, some reader revenue, some, you know, listener revenue. That keeps you in balance so that you understand, you know, that your primary duty is to your listeners and readers. So I've always believed that we should pay for journalism. And the idea that I was pushing is that we should have an easy method. When you go online and you're, you know, listening to one of your station's radio shows online after, you know, a week afterwards, or whether you're getting a copy of Time Magazine or the, you know, the Dallas Morning News or the Houston Chronicle, people say, okay, I'm willing to pay a dime for it or a quarter. I'm willing to pay $10 a year to have the right to read that newspaper. And to me, that would help save journalism, because then we'd have that revenue stream of people who were consuming and reading and using us online.
And it's almost just a matter of we didn't think that it was possible before, so we didn't set it up this way.
Well, you know, I was there at the beginning, you know, in the early 1990s, I was doing new media for Time Magazine, and we created Roadrunner and Pathfinder and all these services, and we assumed that you put up the magazine with a whole lot of extra bells and whistles, and people would, if they paid $50 a year for the magazine, maybe we'd charge them $25 for getting it online because it was cheaper for us. But suddenly we started getting all this advertising revenue. People, you know, young account executives came rushing over from Madison Avenue to the Time Life building, you know, with sacks of money saying, please let us buy ads on your website.
Those days and ended so, far too quickly.
Yeah, and so we kind of got seduced by the fact that, oh, well, we won't have to charge people because everybody wants to buy ads on our website. Well, now we've had the advertising recession in the past few years. We also have the growth of, you know, the exponential growth of millions of websites, but advertising revenue won't ever go up that fast. So we realize that advertising is not going to be the best way to have a business model.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the line to Blake in Dallas. Hey, Blake.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
I was particularly interested in the internal conflict that I guess arises in particularly these individuals, in that I guess, you know, we talk about the tormented artist producing new and valuable information and meaning on life, and how that sort of squares, I guess, how individuals square that away with themselves and the reality that they find.
You know, that's a really good question. And when I'm wrestling with people, I wonder about the relationship between inner turmoil sometimes and creativity. Louis Armstrong, I'm not still sure yet. I'm still wrestling with that one. He was very happy on the surface. How tortured was he inside by the issues of race? And, you know, that's a tricky question, because he always put on that smiling mask of his. As for Benjamin Franklin, I don't think he was a very tortured or conflicted individual. Einstein was. Einstein was a very complex man. You look at a Bill Gates, and he's very sharp and smart analytically, but does he, you know, what type of emotional connections was he able to make when he was younger? Nowadays, he's very personable, emotional, you know, humanistic. But I think for a while he was more analytically driven. And then the most interesting and creative person of our time in that field is Steve Jobs. And Steve Jobs has been a driven perfectionist, somebody who's made some mistakes in his life, but also transformed enormous numbers of industries, whether it's the music industry with the iPod, or the movie industry with Pixar, or the personal computer industry with the Apple II, or hopefully journalism and content with a new Apple tablet. So, and the iPhone was a brilliant thing. And he's somebody who does have a lot of inner depth, complexity, and sometimes turmoil ever since he was a young man. But he's channeled that tumultuous inner life of his into a intense creativity in the public realm.
I was really interested to read in the profile that you did, I guess in 97, of Bill Gates. First of all, that the center of his house that he was then building and that is now complete was a library. But that although he's very widely read, his favorite books are things that, you know, every high school kid has to finish, you know, Catcher in the Rye and The Great Gatsby. Did that surprise you?
It did, in a way. Bill Gates is a very deep and profound reader. He reads a lot, unlike, you know, quite a other few people in the technology industry who aren't big on reading. But he is not deeply into literature and fiction. I mean, he's somebody who once took Richard Feynman's, you know, physics lectures on vacation with him to Mexico. He's somebody who likes reading about organic chemistry when he goes on a trip. So I think, if I, probably too much of a leap to say this, but we'll explore this notion. He is more analytically focused than most people, including maybe Steve Jobs. But he's not as creative. Apple helped popularize the graphical interface we all now look at on our computer screens with trash cans and folders. Microsoft, you know, took it from Apple. Now, of course, Apple had also, Steve Jobs had gone to visit Xerox PARC, but he's the one who perfects that creative way of doing things. I'm not sure that Bill Gates could have as easily invented the iPhone or the iPod, but I also don't think that Steve Jobs could have as easily built a corporation as big as Microsoft. So you see the inner, the sort of creativity of a Steve Jobs and the analytic rigor of a Bill Gates, and that's what I try to explore in this book.
The last thing I want to ask you, Walter, is somewhat selfish because it's something that really struck a chord with me as a journalist. You write about enjoying the balance as you were sort of finding your voice in your work between this deep engagement and detachment as a journalist. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, as a journalist, you realize every now and then that you're an observer. You're on the sidelines. You're watching other people in the arena, as Teddy Roosevelt would have said. And being the detached observer is one of the great themes of both literature, journalism, and life. It's basically what Huckleberry Finn is on the raft. I mean, he can go observe, be a part of things, and just when he's about to become involved in something, they escape and go back onto the raft. It is the theme of most of Hawthorne's work, you know, the notion of the detached observer. Walker Percy, we all have that detached observer in us. And for me, in my life, after the hurricane hit my hometown of New Orleans, I said, okay, I've been an observer, I've been a writer for a long time. I want to now throw myself into being involved in the recovery. And I try to nail balance in my life, whether it's working with the build up of the Palestinian economy on the West Bank in the Middle East, or whether it's helping New Orleans or education reform or Teach for America. We want to get involved in a hands-on way, but also there's that part of us, especially people like you and me who are journalists, who also have a sense of detachment sometimes, and we see ourselves as observers. There's no correct answer to any of those, but it's something I wrestle with because I try to understand myself and those in my trade.
Walter Isaacson is CEO of the Aspen Institute. His newest book is called American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and Heroes of a Hurricane. Walter, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour.
It's spectacular being with you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to those of you who have called and participated in the discussion this hour, and especially thanks to those of you who are joining KERA as supporting members. If you are here with us for the first time and becoming a member today, welcome aboard. If you are ready to make that step, the telephone number is 1-888-694-6931. And if perhaps you are renewing a membership or picking up where you left off, we're of course always happy to have your support as well. Remember, you can also do this online anytime at kera.org. Jeff Whittington is back and he's got a whole little packet of items over there.
Oh, I've got, this is just stack of stuff I've got to go through.
Oh, these are upcoming potential show themes and things
I've got,
for
the Environmental Magazine. Mm-hmm. I got the new issue of Foreign Policy today. I got the new issue of Harper's today. I've got the Amon Carter Museum, program magazine.
Oh, a little light reading.
Yeah, it's look. I'm always looking for that next guest for this show. someone who will engage you as a listener of Think, maybe entice you to call for the 100th time to the show or call for the first time, or maybe get you wound up enough that you'll want to send us an email. Maybe you'll send us a compliment. Maybe you'll send us a complaint. But, you know, either way, you will have engaged with this program. Either way, you will have been listening, and you will have gotten something out of the show, something out of the conversation. That's what it's all about. That's why I have this stack of stuff. Usually always have a stack of stuff. I'm always looking at the news. I'm always trying to figure out what's the next thing that we're going to talk about that you, as a listener, that you will be interested in. And when it comes to membership week, that you'll be willing to pay for.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number to do that. You can also make a contribution at kera.org. You know, the one thing of many things that I like about working with you, Jeff, and with our associate producer, Betsy Lewis, is that you both work really hard to not simply present ideas and book people who are of interest to the three of us on our little team that makes the show. You know, we love to hear from you about what fascinates you, and we love nothing more than to have this perspective on an issue this week and then 2 weeks later have someone with a very different take on it. It doesn't mean that if you threw them in a cage, they would necessarily, you know, tear each other to shreds. My idea is that they would, in fact, have a great conversation and disagree with each other and find places where they did agree and wrestle with maybe the same problems that can't be solved.
Yeah, well, that's what the show's all about. And it's, you know, as my friend Jonik Potoski calls it, the digital campfire, where everybody can get around and talk about things. And you're invited every day from noon to 2, so we're inviting you right now to be an extra special part of the show by contributing whatever dollar amount is right for you at 1-888-694-6931. It's 888-694-6931. It's a toll-free call. We'll pick up the charge for your call, or you can go online to kera.org, click on the support button there, and you can contribute online. You won't even have to have a human moment. And you can just take care of it at whatever level is right for you. If you listen to this show every day, if you listen to KERA every day, maybe a dollar a day is the right level for you. It's $365. And gosh, it sure would help a lot if you were to contribute at that level, because, you know, your contribution at $365 may influence someone else to contribute at a level that's right for them. And pretty soon we've got enough contributions that we can end the drive and go right back to the regular schedule.
Yeah, and 1-888-694-6931 is our telephone number. You can also go online to kera.org. Jeff alluded to this. Please do not underestimate the influence that you have on your friends and family and coworkers. You know, it's one of those things where people might not realize that you're a public radio subscriber, that you contribute. And then if they find that out, they'll think, well, if Bob and Suzanne do it, then I'm going to do it too. And you'd be surprised how many people just didn't know that a lot of people contribute to public radio.
Yeah, and it's okay if you don't want everybody to know. You know, if you're...
we can keep it quiet if you want to.
Like PJ O'Rourke has said in the past, you know, pledge so that there's something to hate on the air. You know, if you fall...
Frequent guest of the show, we should say.
he is a regular guest. And if you fall into that camp, that's fine, you know. We love the fact that you get something out of this programming, even if you don't always agree. And I hope that you don't always agree with the guests that we have on the show, because that's not what we're all about. We're not all about making or reinforcing everyone's opinion of how the world is. We're all about helping you decide how the world is for you. And that's what public radio is all about. It brings you a variety of viewpoints, a diversity of ideas, philosophies of life, a bunch of different looks at the way the world is happening and things that are happening around the world, and then lets you decide, how do I think about this? And that's part of the reason we call the show Think, is because it's up to you to decide what you think about this stuff. We're just asking you, it's also up to you, but we're asking you to contribute some dollars to help keep this programming alive.
Maybe you just haven't thought until now about adding public radio to your budget. You haven't thought about, okay, as I'm deciding what to do with my money every month, every week, every year, public radio didn't really figure in. Well, we are asking as directly as we can everyone who listens to this station regularly. And that's just about everyone who's within the sound of my voice. There may be some of you that thought you were getting something else and you're about to flip off. But most of you who are listening right now love public radio. If you are a public radio listener, we are asking you to make a contribution. You decide the amount. You might want to give $10. You might want to give $10,000. That's up to you. But we ask that you go online to make it at KERA.org or call us at 1-800-694-6931.
It's actually 888-694-6931.
I'm sorry.
6931. You got to remember that, 888.
We've got a new number and we are all.
It is a new number. It is a new number, but it's a toll-free number and it still works the same.
It does.
888-694-6931. 1-888-694-6931 is the number to call or contribute online at KERA.org.
By the end of this campaign, I will have that number memorized and then I'll have to learn it all over again for the next time we do this. Remember, you can also make a contribution online at KERA.org. You can use a credit or a debit card, or you can set up a sustaining membership, which is a great deal for you and also great for us in terms of planning contributions. 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.
Includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.